This is Fresh Air. I'm Barbara Bogave, in for Terry Gross. Over his 20-year history with the Boston Philharmonic Orchestra, Benjamin Zander has earned an international reputation as one of the most ambitious conductors in the business, daring to take on the great masters of the classical repertoire. He's known as an expert on the music of Gustav Mahler. His new CD set, a recording of a live performance of Mahler's Ninth with the London Philharmonia, was just nominated for a Grammy. Let's listen to this passage from the first movement. This new recording includes an extra third disc in which Zander talks about the symphony, exploring the emotional dynamics of Mahler's music and the composer's tragic life. The discussion is drawn from Zander's hugely popular pre-concert talks. He also includes the first two pages of his own score, complete with conducting notes. Here's an example of his analysis of the music we just heard.
At the beginning of the second page, bar 14, the second violin is still unfolding its long-breathed lament. But as it falls and dies away, morendo, dying, Mahler instructs, the second horn, with the added color of the bassoon, now becomes the chief mourner, reiterating that most disturbing of intervals, the tritone, C-sharp to G. And here it is with the orchestra. At the same time, in bar 15, Mahler adds the voice of the even sadder English horn. Three times the English horn sighs, first the familiar falling motive, F-sharp to E, then one note higher, then higher still, this last time heavy with sorrowful accents on every note.
Ben Zander says he thinks of himself primarily as a teacher. He's on the faculty of the New England Conservatory of Music and is the musical director and conductor of their Youth Philharmonic Orchestra. I asked him why he included his conducting score in the new CD.
Well, there are two reasons. One is it's a fascinating way of entering a score, because otherwise how would an ordinary person be able to look at a score unless somebody were to guide them through it by pointing out everything that a conductor would need to know? There's another reason, which is that if you focus for a moment on every element in the music and realize that every note and every gesture and every shape and every phrasing means something in the whole, that gives you an insight how to listen. And that's my main purpose. I believe that every human being has the capacity to respond to great music and to be touched and moved by it and to have their lives changed by it. And so this is the best way of drawing people in, namely to say, listen to this note, and then listen to that, and then now listen to this, and see what this is doing while that's happening, and think about the meaning and the implication of that. And gradually people get drawn in, and people have told me, people who've never had any training in music whatsoever, have told me they've been riveted by that experience, and they've used it as a way of getting inside the music and listening to the rest of the piece, since obviously I only do that for two pages. To listen to the rest of the piece with their eyes and ears wide open.
Do you think that it's similar to what people say about poetry, that as children we have this innate ability to interact, to experience the music, to feel it, and that we,
yes,
we lose that as we get older, unless you nourish it?
We lose it the way we lose all sorts of things in life. You know, you were a seven-year-old child and you were singing in a choir and the teacher said, don't actually sing. I'd prefer it if you would just mouth the words because you're spoiling the sound of the choir. And that child grows up to be somebody who later on says, I'm tone deaf and can't hear music. And that's all it is. It's somebody simply closing down a door which used to be open. I feel my role is partly to open those doors again, to remind people of the power of this music and how deeply affecting it can be, even if you have no academic training in it or don't even really know the difference between, you know, a dominant seventh and a minor third. But somehow this music is, we are permeable to this music if we allow ourselves to be, and we close down all the conversations which tell us that we can't do it.
You have an interesting professional history with this this music, with Mahler and Mahler's Ninth. I think over 20 years ago you were fired as the conductor of the Boston Civic Symphony by its board because you presented this symphony. You presented such difficult music. What so provoked them? What did they not like about it?
Well, I'd done a lot of, as they called it, mela. They didn't like the music. It was too difficult. You know, this was an orchestra that wanted to be entertained. One of the board members asked me why I didn't perform any of the Chopin symphonies. Well, of course, I said I had no time to write any. But this was not a group of people who wanted to be challenged to the ultimate. And so they saw this as a kind of confrontation. They fired me because they felt that the orchestra was going in the wrong direction. And what happened next was that the entire orchestra resigned, all 98 players. And I think the reason for that was because the players themselves saw this as a wonderful path to be going on, to be delving deep into this music. We had a long period of rehearsal time because it was a community orchestra. And so I believe we had 22 rehearsals for that performance over a three-month period. And it really transformed the lives of the people who participated. And they weren't about to give that up. So they went on with what is now the Boston Philharmonic.
Now, we've been talking about how difficult and complex this music is. And you do say in the discussion of Mahler's Ninth that especially in this third movement of it, that you wonder why the first-time listener would want to listen. They might ask themselves, why should I listen to this? It's so bleak. It's so hard to follow. And that yes. You know someone who always leaves it out when he listens
right.
to this symphony.
Well, it's the old recordings, you know, on the LPs, it was on four sides. And so he could conveniently go from the end of the first movement to the last movement, which is gorgeous and beautiful and very, very satisfying and to listen to. And he left out those middle two movements. And what I believe, of course, is that we have to go through the struggle of the middle movements to the dark night of the soul in order to appreciate coming out the other side, so that when we finally get to the pages at the end of the Ninth Symphony where he expresses his own mortality, his own death, we have been on a long, arduous struggle and come out the other side. If you have avoided the struggle, obviously you don't appreciate and don't experience the whole thing. That's the flaw with the approach to music, which we see so much nowadays, of taking little bits, the sort of the best moments of an opera or the best moments of a symphony, and pretending that that is the work. The experience of music is very much that of a journey, of going from one place to another. It's a transformational experience. You start in one place, you go through the journey, and you emerge the other side. And we have to go through that journey in order to fully experience the outcome.
Let's listen then to the third movement of Mahler's Ninth. And Ben, would you like to say anything before we listen
to
music?
Well, the thing about this movement is that it's enormously complex. This is about as complex as music can get in terms of polyphony, of the voices that are piled one on top of the other. In this, he's like Bach, and in fact, he was influenced by Bach. The tempo which I chose for this performance is a little bit slower than it's often heard, and the reason for that is in order to make sure that every single voice is clearly heard, so that the complexity of the language of every single moment is experience. And when in the end it goes over the edge, it really goes into madness, into a complete hysteria at the end in the final section. That is then a feeling of going over a precipice, of having experienced everything and gone over the edge. Of course, the consolation of the final movement has to be experienced too in order to get the full weight of that. But it is a chilling, grim, forbidding experience, although so masterful in its expression and its technique that it blows one's mind.
Let's listen. This is the third movement of Mahler's Ninth.
Thank you.
That's my guest, Benjamin Zander, leading the Philharmonia Orchestra of London in a live performance of Mahler's Ninth. Now, I want Ben to play a little bit of the final movement of this symphony, because as you said earlier, you want to get to the resolution of
the consolation.
The consolation of the final movement. And the beginning, I find myself listening to this, holding my breath, waiting to exhale. Is that what you're consciously leading your orchestra to create that effect?
Definitely. I'm thrilled that you have that feeling. And actually, at the end of that movement, there's a 56-second silence before anybody dared to applaud after the performance. And that's the same thing you're talking about. Mahler has the capacity of holding us in thrall, where the lines are so long, where the tension is so great, that he simply doesn't allow us to breathe. And if we allow the music to unfold in that way, we can hold 2,000 people in a hall in that kind of spell. And it's one of the few things that can do that.
Let's listen to the fourth movement, the beginning of the fourth movement of Mahler's Ninth. That's my guest, Benjamin Zander, leading the Philharmonia Orchestra of London in a live performance of Mahler's Ninth. For this music, do you make a conscious effort to develop the individuality of your musicians rather than trying to homogenize the sound of the orchestra?
Yes, that gets at the absolute central idea of Mahler's music. In most music, we're taught to make all the voices amalgamate, as you say, homogenize. That's a perfect way of describing it, where everything is related and listening carefully to everything else, and it all sounds very pretty. The secret of Mahler's music is that every single individual voice is separate from every other, and that makes it profoundly modern. Each voice, each instrument seems to have a life of its own. And sometimes he calls on an instrument to play very softly, and at the same time another instrument might be playing very loud and raucously. And it's actually quite a discipline to get an orchestra to realize that and not make the quiet person play a little louder and the loud person a little softer to make it all belong together. And that is at the absolute core of his expression, and I think tells us something about who we are as people, and is a unique voice for Mahler that he does that. And I put a particular emphasis on teaching orchestras to do that, and that's one of the characteristics of the performance.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Benjamin Zander. He is the conductor of the Boston Philharmonic. He teaches at the New England Conservatory and conducts their Youth Philharmonic Orchestra. He's also served as guest conductor for numerous other orchestras in this country and abroad. Ben, let's take a break, and then we'll talk some more. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Boston Philharmonic conductor Benjamin Zander. Now, how do you decide as a conductor where to take liberties with a piece and to depart from the notations of a composer and when to adhere to them as faithfully as you can?
Well, in general, I'm one who believes in adhering faithfully to what the composer wrote. And I will actually go to quite extremes to do that. I really believe these composers were taking us into often counterintuitive places, places where we wouldn't go just on our own naturally by following our instincts. And so I think it behooves us to follow exactly what they had in mind. And the Beethoven performances are based not only on following every dynamic marking and every phrasing, but also the tempi that he left through the metronome marks. And that makes them very unusual because most people have disregarded those tempo marks and say they're unreasonable or they're too fast or they don't work or whatever. I have taken him at his word, always asking the question, could he have meant it? Could he have meant it? So in general, I would say we follow religiously what the composer has given us. In some cases, I find myself changing what's there. And there would always have to be a very special reason why that I would do that.
Can you give us an example of when you would take a different path?
Well, I might take a different path if I simply cannot understand what the composer meant. The first movement of the Prokofiev Fifth Symphony is at a tempo so slow that I cannot make it work at that tempo. Now, there's something, either I'm wrong about it or he simply wrote the wrong tempo. I think it's perfectly possible that either is true. That would be one example. There's a fascinating example in Stravinsky of The Rite of Spring, where what the composer wrote and what I believe he intended was something different. That happened because we have a piano roll of Stravinsky, not actually playing, but a piano roll he supervised of the final section, the Danse Sacrale, where the piano roll is 30 points faster on the metronome than his own performances and what he wrote in the score. And it's possible that the faster tempo, thrilling and exciting as it is, was simply too hard to play or too hard to conduct, and so he reduced the tempo so that it would be more comfortable. I think in the process, he lost some of the power and the incredible excitement of hearing this at a breakneck speed. This is, after all, suggesting a young virgin dancing herself to death. And at the slower tempo, I suspect she would hardly break a sweat. At the faster tempo, you can really feel the frenzy and the desperation and the terror. And I think it makes a much more effective interpretation, though Stravinsky himself neither did it nor wrote it.
Now, I know you brought two examples of the Rite of Spring with you so that we could hear this.
Yes.
Maybe we could play them.
Good. Well, you can hear, first of all, there's a performance of Stravinsky playing, say, the last minute of the Danse Sacrale at the tempo that he chose both to mark in the score and to perform it at. And then immediately afterwards, we could play the same passage played by the Boston Philharmonic at the tempo of the piano roll.
And now the Boston Philharmonic's recording from a live performance of the last minute of the Danse Sacrale. Thank you. The Boston Philharmonic performing Stravinsky's The Rite of Spring, conducted by my guest Benjamin Zander. We'll talk more in the second half of the show. This is Fresh Air. This is Fresh Air. I'm Barbara Bogave, in for Terry Gross. My guest, Benjamin Zander, has conducted the Boston Philharmonic for over 20 years. He's also a popular guest conductor for orchestras in this country and abroad. His new CD, a recording of a live performance of Mahler's Ninth Symphony by the London Philharmonia, has just been nominated for a Grammy. Zander began his musical career as a cellist. Ben, your father was an amateur orchestral musician. What did he play?
He played the viola.
And you,
and also the piano, and he also composed.
Ah, you played the cello as a child.
Right,
you started very young. Was the cello your choice or your father's?
No, it was my choice. I started on the piano and then composing, and then at about the age of 9, I became a cellist.
What were your first compositions like?
Well, actually, there's quite an amusing story about that, because I wrote several compositions when I was 9, and my mother put them in for an arts festival in the village, you know, where we lived in England. And the man came down from London who was an adjudicator, and he was to hand out the results of the competition, and he held my compositions up in the air in front of the entire village in the village hall and said, "These compositions are so bad that not only can they not be considered for the competition, that goes without saying, but I think this young man should be discouraged from ever composing again." Well, that tells you.
But then
my mother, bless her, sent the compositions in an envelope with his comments and a letter to Benjamin Britten for a second opinion. And the telephone went 4 days later, and it was Benjamin Britten on the phone. I was quite stunned. I picked up the phone. Here's Benjamin Britten. I could have been Beethoven. I said, "Mom, it's Benjamin Britten." Anyway, he got on the phone to my mother, and he said, your son's compositions are fine, and if you want to come and spend your summer holidays in Aldborough, where I live, this beautiful English fishing village, I would be happy to oversee his development. And that happened for 4 summers. We went to Aldborough, and I studied with Benjamin Britten, and it changed my life. So those comments can go either way, you know.
He sounds as if he were a wonderful teacher and communicator.
Yes, Britten was a wonderful human being, very gentle and gracious, and always spoke somehow through the voice of children. He was fascinated by innocence and its dissolution, all his operas about the threat to innocence, and I think he was drawn to that quality and to children, and he was an extraordinary mentor for me.
Now, you left home and you left school at the age of 15 to study with the great Spanish cellist Gaspar Casado in Florence. Did you have an adopted family there to keep you out of trouble?
Yes, I started off living in a pension, you know, for several months, and then I joined a family and stayed away from home actually for 5 years. I never went back to school. That was my life, and I traveled all over Europe with him. I was in that relationship with him as master to apprentice. You know, that was a very special relationship that hardly exists anymore. But it's something that is very valuable, where you're actually deeply engaged with somebody at all levels. And I traveled enormously with him and learned my craft, as it were, on the court.
Why didn't you pursue a soloist career?
Well, I had a deficiency in my fingers, funnily enough. I couldn't produce calluses on my finger ends, so it was very painful to play the cello. And so that was not an possibility for me, but it is as very often happens in life, when a door closes, another one opens up, and as a result, I turned to conducting.
What does that mean? You couldn't create calluses like any other person? Did your fingers bleed?
Yes, my fingers bled. Yes, that is a condition that one doesn't hear about it very much, because not many people need calluses. There aren't many professions for which you need that, but in fact, my fingers would bleed when I played too much.
Did you perceive it then as a huge failure?
Well, it was a crisis for me, because that's what I'd always assumed I would be, a professional cellist, and I'd planned my life for that. But of course, this often turns out to be the case. You never know what are the good things and what are the bad things, and it often is that way.
How'd you get your first conducting job?
By telling a lie. It was a very simple thing. I got a job as a cellist and as a chamber music teacher at a summer school in Lenox. And at the end of the interview, the lady who ran the camp said, "Incidentally, we're looking for a conducting a person to conduct the orchestra. Do you know anybody? And I said, oh, I'd love to do that. And she said, are you very experienced? And I said, yes, oh, very experienced. Well, in a sense, that was a lie. And in a sense, it wasn't, because, of course, I'd been a teacher and a chamber music coach for many, many years. And being very expressive with my hands and arms and so on, of course, what I'd been doing all those years was actually conducting, although it was small groups and individuals rather than a large orchestra. But that's essentially what a conductor is. It's somebody who is giving physical life to a musical idea. And in that sense, I was quite experienced.
Benjamin Zander, conductor of the Boston Philharmonic. Last year, he celebrated his 20th anniversary with the Boston Philharmonic and his 60th birthday with an acclaimed performance of Mahler's Eighth Symphony. He's again conducting the orchestra in Mahler's Eighth at Symphony Hall in Boston on January 17th and at Carnegie Hall in New York City on January 19th. Here's Benjamin Zander conducting the New England Conservatory's Youth Philharmonic Orchestra in Leonard Bernstein's overture to Candide. Coming up, psychiatrist Edward Hollowell on scheduling meaning into our lives. This is Fresh Air.